here just a couple of weeks ago, and you sent a testimony, I think this is going to be a lot more fun. Possibly more fun. I'm going to challenge you today to revise your thinking and to reconsider some fundamental assumptions. Assumptions are so deeply embedded in our consciousness that we don't even realize that they're there. This is a map by the artist Tom Friedman. Well, I have to tell you, my favorite story about wrong assumptions is it's a story about a guy who goes on vacation and he leaves his cat with his best friend. And he's on vacation in Riviera and his friend calls up and he says, listen, the cat got up on the roof and we couldn't get her down. So we called the fire department and then the cat jumped to a tree and the fire department wasn't able to get the cat, so the cat fell and the cat's dead. The man goes, oh my God, said, how could you do that to me? He said, well, what was I supposed to do? He said, well, you have to prepare me. He said, first you call me on the first day and say, the cat's on the roof and we can't get her down. Then on the second day, you call me and you say, you call the fire department and the cat's jumped to the tree. And then the third day, you tell me the cat fell and died. But then I'm prepared. And I said, that's the way you want it? He said, yes, that's the way I want it. Goes back to his vacation. A few days later, the man calls him again and says, your mother's up on the roof and we can't get her down. So this is Tom Friedman's map of the United States. The assumptions I'm talking about today represent another kind of map, a map that tells us the way that the world works. Since this is a talk on complexity, you won't be surprised to hear that one important assumption that most people make is the assumption of linearity in a world that's largely nonlinear. I hope that by the end of this discussion, many of that statement will be clear, but we won't get there in linear fashion. Some of you know I've written a book that many people find controversial. It's called State of Fear, and it actually does concern fear. But I want to tell you how I came to write it. I had very conventional ideas about the environment and the success of the environmental movement until about 5 years ago. The book State of Fear really began in 1998 when I decided to write a novel about a global disaster. In the course of my preparation, I rather casually reviewed what had happened in Chernobyl, since that was the worst man-made disaster in recent times that I knew about. What I discovered stunned me. Chernobyl was a tragic event, but nothing remotely close to the global catastrophe that I was imagining. About 50 people had died in Chernobyl, roughly the number of Americans that die every day in traffic accidents. I don't mean to be gruesome, but that was a setback for me. You can't write a novel about a global disaster in which only 50 people die. Undaunted, I began to research other kinds of disasters that might fill my novelistic requirements. That's when I began to realize how big our planet really is, and how resilient its systems seem to be. Even though I wanted to create a fictional catastrophe of global proportions, I found it hard to come up with a credible example. In the end, I set the book aside and wrote Prey instead. But the shock that I experienced reverberated in me for a long time, because what I had been led to believe about Chernobyl was not merely wrong, it was astonishingly wrong. Let's review that. At the time of the Chernobyl disaster, which is over here, the estimate for the number of deaths was 2,000. The numbers began to climb. We see later in that same year that it went up to 14,000. In 87, the time slope, there were 2,000. The numbers bounced up and down until around the year 2000. The BBC was estimating 15,000 to 30,000 deaths. The French had picked it up, and the New York Times in 2002 also estimated 15,000 to 30,000 deaths. The actual number of deaths here, you can't actually see because it's so small. Now, to report that 15 to 30,000 people are dead, a national number is 56, represents a very large error. Let's try to get some idea of exactly how big the error is. Suppose we line up all the victims in a row. If 56 people are each represented by 1 foot of space, then 56 feet is roughly the distance from me to the second or third row of the auditorium. 15,000 people is 3 miles away. It seems very difficult to make a mistake of that scale. But of course you say to yourself probably, we're talking about radiation. What about long-term consequences? Unfortunately for the media, their reports here are even less accurate. So CNN in 96 is estimating 3.5 million future deaths and illnesses from radiation. The BBC in 2000 estimates 50,000. Agence Presse in 2001, 500,000. Ukrainian victims group, 150,000. Frontline, 16,000. UN Commission, which studied this year, estimates 4,000. Again, a very troubling number. 4,000 people is the number of Americans who die of adverse drug reactions in this country every 6 weeks. So it's, again, a very large error. But most troubling of all, according to this UN report, 2005, is that the largest public health problem created by the accident was the damaging psychological impact due to a lack of accurate information, manifesting as negative self-assessments of health, belief in a shortened life expectancy, lack of initiative, and dependency on assistance from the state. In other words, the greatest damage to the people of Chernobyl was caused by bad information. These people weren't blighted by radiation so much as by terrifying but false information. We ought to ponder for a minute exactly what that implies. We demand strict controls on radiation because it's such a health hazard. But clearly, Chernobyl suggests that false information can be a health hazard as damaging as radiation. I'm not saying radiation is not a threat. I'm not saying that Chernobyl is not a genuinely serious event. But thousands of Ukrainians who didn't die were made invalids out of fear. They were told to be afraid. They were told they were going to die when they weren't. They were told their children would be deformed when they weren't. They were told they couldn't have children when they could. They were authoritatively promised a future of cancer, deformities, pain, and decay. It's no wonder they responded as they did. In fact, we need to recognize that this kind of human response is well documented. Authoritatively telling people that they're going to die can in itself be fatal. You may know that Australian Aborigines fear something called pointing the bone. The shaman shakes a bone at a person and sings a song, and soon after the person dies. This is a specific example of a phenomenon generally referred to as hex death. A person is cursed by an authority figure and then dies. According to medical studies, the person generally dies of dehydration, implying that they just give up. But the progression is very erratic, and shock symptoms may play a part, suggesting adrenal effects of fright and hopelessness. Yet this deadly curse is nothing but information, and it can be undone with information. I have to tell you a story. A friend of mine was an intern at Bellevue in New York about 15 years ago. A 28-year-old man from the Caribbean came to the emergency room and said he was going to die because he'd been cursed. He was admitted for a psychiatric evaluation and was found to be normal, but his health steadily declined. My friend was able to rehydrate him, balance his electrolytes, give him nutrients. But nevertheless, the man worsened, insisting that he was cursed and there was nothing that could be done for him. My friend realized that this patient would, in fact, soon die. The situation was desperate. So finally, he told the patient that he, the doctor, was going to invoke his own powerful medicine to undo the curse. And his medicine was more powerful than any other. And then he got together with some of the house staff and bought some headdresses and rattles and danced around the patient in the middle of the night, chanting what he hoped would be effective sounding phrases. Mostly they were trying to remember what they said at bar mitzvahs. The patient showed no reaction, but the next day he began to improve. He went home a few days later, and I would say that my friend literally saved his life. This suggests that the Ukrainian invalids are not unique in their response, but by the large numbers of them, makes us understand that what we might call information casualties represent a particularly egregious example of what can happen from false fears. Once I looked at Chernobyl, I began to remember other fears in my life that had never come true. The population bomb, for one. Paul Ehrlich predicted mass starvation in 1960. 60 million Americans starving to death. Didn't happen. Other scientists warned of mass species extinctions by 2000. Ehrlich himself predicted that half of all species would become extinct by the year 2000. That didn't happen. Club of Rome told us we would run out of raw materials ranging from oil to copper by the 1990s. That didn't happen either. It's no surprise that predictions frequently don't come true. But such big ones, and so many, Woody Allen once said that he was at two with nature, and that seemed to sum up the attitudes of a whole era. All my life, I worried about the decay of the environment, the tragic loss of species, the collapse of ecosystems. I worried a lot. Poisoned by pesticides, aller and apples, falling sperm counts from endocrine disruptors, cancer from power lines, cancer from saccharin, cancer from cell phones, cancer from computer screens, cancer from food coloring, hairsprays, electric razors, electric blankets, coffee, chlorinated water. It never seemed to end. In fact, it didn't end. Only once, when on the same day I read that beer was a preservative of heart muscle, and also a carcinogen. Only once that I began to sense the bind that I was in. For the most part, I just went along with what I was being told. But Chernobyl started me on a new path. When I began to research these old fears to find out what had been said in the past, I discovered several important things. The first is that there is nothing more sobering than a 30-year-old newspaper. You can't figure out what the headlines mean. You don't know who the people are. Theodore Green, John Sparkman, George Reedy, Jack Watson, Kenneth Duberstein, Don Regan, some of those you may know here. But you thumb through page after page of vanished concerns, issues that apparently were vitally important at the time and now don't matter at all. It's amazing how many pressing concerns are literally of the moment. They won't matter in 6 months and certainly not in 6 years. And if they won't matter then, are they really worth our attention now? But as David Berkeley once said, the one function TV news performs very well is that when there is no news, we give it to you with the same emphasis as if there were. The second thing I discovered was that attempts to provoke fear tended to employ a certain kind of stereotypic, very intense language. For example, here's a climate quote. We simply cannot afford to gamble by ignoring it. We cannot risk inaction. Those scientists who say we are merely entering a period of climatic instability are acting irresponsibly. The indications that our climate can soon change for the worse are too strong to be reasonably ignored. That's familiar language, isn't it? But it's not about global warming, it's about global cooling. Fear of the new ice age. Anybody here worried about a new ice age? Is anybody upset that we didn't act now back then to stockpile food and all the other things we were warned we had to do? Here's a quote from a famous 1970s computer study that predicted a dire future for mankind unless we act now. We are unanimously convinced that rapid radical redressment of the present unbalanced and dangerously deteriorated world situation is the primary task facing mankind. Concerted international measures and joint long-term planning will be necessary on a scale and scope without precedent. This supreme effort is founded on a basic change in values and goals at individual, national, and world levels. Okay, now, let's just look at the words for a minute. Rapid, radical, regressive, unbalanced, dangerously deteriorated world situations, scale and scope without precedent, supreme effort, basic change in values. That was actually to avoid all the termination of resources that occurred in the 1990s that we all remember so well. Here's a third quote from Paul Ehrlich's population model. The operation, that is, we just seen that population, will demand many apparently brutal and heartless decisions. The pain may be intense, but the disease is so far advanced that only with radical surgery does the patient have a chance to survive. Are you getting a sense about the sameness? Here's a quote from the UN.